This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, for 11 days, Hamas was firing rockets into Israel, and Israel was responding with strong military retaliation. But that has ended, at least for now, as of last night. To learn about the details of this ceasefire and the larger implications for Israel and the Middle East, we'll turn to our Jerusalem correspondent, Brent.
Yeah, as you said, this was 11 days of pretty intense fighting on behalf of both Hamas, firing rockets into Israel. Over 4,000 rockets were fired, especially the first couple of days of that was the highest frequency of rockets ever fired into Israel, especially towards the major population centers of along the coast, including Tel Aviv. And Israel, in response, they dropped 1,000 bombs into Gaza, which is absolutely just absolutely decimated a lot of infrastructure that Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the other terrorist group that operates out of Gaza, destroying a lot of their infrastructure, including about 100 kilometers of underground tunnels that where Hamas uses. This is about 60 miles of underground tunnels that Hamas uses to store weapons and transport their fighters through this really small enclave. That's about 10% of the actual length of underground tunnels that are there in Gaza. That's what Hamas spends a lot of its money on. Now, as far as the people that were killed, there were 12 Israelis that were killed in the rocket attacks themselves, or at least 12 in Israel. Three of them were foreign nationals. And then there were about 230, I think, Palestinians. There's slightly different numbers. The IDF killed 160 of those are terrorist targets. They can name most of those people that were killed. So we're talking about 60 dead civilians around that. That's by the numbers that Hamas gives. So perhaps even less than that. And especially considering the fact that one-third of Hamas's rockets, they don't make it out of the Gaza Strip. A lot of those civilians were probably killed by Hamas rockets landing inside the enclave, which a lot of Israelis will bring this up, and you won't hear this into the international media, but there's probably never been a war or never been a battle as cleanly fought as Israel has fought in the past 11 days. Really, absolutely, comparatively, there's no civilian casualties, or hardly any civilian casualties caused by Israel, if you can think of targeting 1,000 different targets and only 60 civilians killed at the high end. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely phenomenal. However, of course, every lost life, we're not going to talk belittle that. Nevertheless, this was a pretty surgical attack by Israel, that Israel believes that they have degraded Hamas sufficiently. A lot of Israeli public are not happy with this result because they just see it as mowing the grass, as we've talked about before, this concept of every few years there is going to be a war. Before, in the intermediate years, there will be sporadic rocket fire on the border communities of Israel that don't go in, that still have to run to shelters and all of that, and they're not going to, even though there isn't a war on. And so most of the Israeli public are not happy with this ceasefire because Hamas isn't, they're still in power, they still rule over the Gaza Strip, and they're going to do it again. But Israel was, say, facing a lot of international pressure mm-hmm. to stop their attacks inside the Gaza Strip against Hamas.
Yeah, how much, well, there's a lot to talk about here, but just with the last point that you made about the international pressure, the Biden administration certainly came out and strongly advised the Israeli government, the Netanyahu government, to make this ceasefire. How much was that a decisive factor here?
That was by far the decisive factor. If the Biden administration, or if the Trump administration, let's say, was in power, there would not be a ceasefire right now. Israel would continue to try and rout Hamas completely as much as they can. I mean, there's no easy solutions for what's going on in the Gaza Strip. However, this would have gone on longer. However, a day and a half ago, President Biden would say, de-escalate now, ceasefire now. And Israel, once it had a lot of its military objectives met, felt like, okay, well, it's not worth breaking that brotherhood over this issue right now. A lot of Israel's military is intertwined with the United States, such as the replenishment of the Iron Dome missile batteries. A lot of those weapons come from the United States. A lot of the anti-rocket missiles that are fired into the air to stop the Hamas missiles come from the United States. And there was already a movement inside Congress to try and stop many of the Democrats to try and stop the selling of those weapons to Israel. And so Israel is caught between a rock and a hard place. Biden's pressure did cause this ceasefire, which they would say is they're rejoicing over that fact. However, Israel is not happy with this and definitely would have tried to go about it doing a lot more damage to Hamas.
You had a very interesting article just a few days ago on thetrumpet.com. Iran is taking over the Palestinian street, and there's a lot of evidence to show that Iran has been behind this from the very beginning, and that they're actually changing their tactics here, that we're seeing something new from Iran. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and I think this is the important point that everyone is not going to get, but you have to remember that Hamas does not act without its direction coming from Iran. Hamas would not have had the ultimatums on Israel on May 10th that said, get all of your Israeli policemen off the Temple Mount and stop this eviction happening in the north of Jerusalem, or else we're going to launch thousands of rockets on you. Hamas does not do that if Iran doesn't do it. And so we must see what's going on with the broader context of this is just one of Iran's proxies, one of Iran's assets in the larger war against the state of Israel. And significantly, there was a pretty big change for Hamas during this. They have now, and they've announced this, that they have moved their, let's say, it's part of their motivation for fighting against the state of Israel to not just include Israeli attacks on Gaza or specific attacks on Hamas, but Hamas is now going to protect what it says, defending all Palestinians living in historical Palestine, including Al-Quds, so including Jerusalem. So this means that if there is an Israeli action against Israeli Arabs, there's over a million Israeli Arabs, Arab citizens of Israel, living in East Jerusalem, living through Arab towns inside Jerusalem or Israel in the 48 borders, as they call it. This is not in the West Bank. And Hamas and Iran are directly appealing to those people now to join the fight against Israel. And Hamas has said, we are going to act on your behalf now. We are going to come to the aid of the East Jerusalemites, the Arab East Jerusalemites. If an Israeli tries to take your house or tries to evict you, we are going to fight against Israel and defend you. And this was extremely successful, motivating a lot of support throughout Hamas, throughout the Israel for Hamas. This is the reason why we saw massive riots throughout Israeli cities inside Israel, not in the West Bank, not in Ramallah or Nablus or all these other places, but in Israeli cities, in Haifa in the north, the fourth largest city of Israel, in Akko or on the coast in the north, in Lod just by the airport, synagogues burning, Arabs roaming the streets, beating up Israelis. There was a lot, and Hamas flags being flown all through the center of Israel throughout this week of fighting shows that there were lots of Palestinian Israelis or Arab Israelis that are now feeling that Hamas represents them. And this is a big change, and Carolyn Glick brings this out in one of her pieces just from today, to show that there was, it seemed, in a follow-on from the Abraham Accords, that there were many Arab Israelis that were kind of starting to lay down their arms in their mindset and recognizing that it's okay to not fight against the state of Israel. Look, we have Bahrain, we have Sudan, we have Morocco, we have the UAE signing peace deals. Egypt's got a peace deal. Jordan's got a peace deal with Israel. So how about we ourselves come to some type of reconciliation with the state of Israel and recognize that, yes, we are in the Jewish state, but that's okay. We can live here. We don't have to have this perpetual fight. And this is extremely dangerous for Iran's game plan. Iran's game plan is on the opposite end of the Abraham Accords, is trying to blow the Abraham Accords up, is trying to restore the Palestinian issue to the forefront of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And so they want Hamas to make Arabs pick sides. And they want Hamas. And even in the political scene, you did have a lot of moderate, well, some moderate Arabs come up in the spirit of the Abraham Accords and say that are members of the Knesset that said, okay, Israelis, Arab, Jew, let's get together, let's work this out. And so Carolyn Glick believes that this was a pretty big attempt by Iran to try and stop that, stop the success of the Abraham Accords taking effect on Arab Israelis and Palestinians. And at the same time, you have Hamas, Iran talking about, for the first time in the history of Hamas, we are now calling on the Arab citizens of Israel to rise up and fight against the state of Israel underneath the banner of Hamas. There is a ceasefire going on right now. And why is there riots still today on the Temple Mount? Why is there riots in North Jerusalem? Why are there still Hamas flags flying? Yes, they're celebrating what they see as a victory in the rocket war against Israel, but the fight for Jerusalem has just begun. The rocket war is largely a sideshow for what Hamas has done, motivating the Arab street to then include the larger battle for Israel. I believe, and even a lot of Israeli commentators are noting this as well.
You talk about just how opposed to the Abraham Accords Iran is. What's striking to me is just how much the Biden administration has been exactly aligned with that thinking. They're doing everything they can to undermine those accords. And even all of this latest fighting, they're actually using it as leverage to try to undermine those accords yet further.
Yeah, and I think that you do see, as you said, the Biden administration, Iran, in lockstep in this issue. And it is hard for most Westerners to actually wrap their minds around that. But if you follow where the evidence leads, you will see that the United States is currently, the same day that kind of a tangent, but the same day that President Biden says, ceasefire now, de-escalate now, the United States is in Vienna negotiating a new Iran deal, which the Iranian leader comes out of that deal, of that negotiation, saying we're pretty much done and dusted. And so you've got money that's about to go, if you could imagine a bag of money going from the United States to Iran, and then Iran passing that same bag of money to Hamas, and then Hamas buying rockets, making rockets and firing at Israel. It is that simple. And even Psaki, the White House spokesperson, yeah, Jen Psaki, she said this, I think this was 2 days ago. She said, aside from putting forward a peace proposal that was dead on arrival, we don't think they, meaning the Trump administration, did anything constructive, really, to bring an end to the longstanding conflict in the Middle East. So that's their opinion of the deals that Trump worked out.
That's
nothing
stunning.
Constructive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you're asking Israelis, they clearly see that the Biden administration is firmly in the Iranian camp in this. Yes, they want a ceasefire. Why? They wanted a ceasefire because Hamas was happy with a ceasefire. Hamas was beaten down inside the Gaza Strip. I'm not going to say they weren't. But if you look at Iran fighting against Israel, this is just one asset. And what Iran sees right now is a massive victory for the palace for destroying the Abraham Accords, for at least undermining them, and for really empowering Hamas and the Iranian cause for the Palestinians in the mind of the Palestinians themselves. Now, one thing that we know, this is not going away because we have Hamas now opening the Jerusalem front. We have these court cases, just a really simple court case between a Jewish owner of a property and Arab tenants that haven't paid for the past 40 years. It happens to be just over the road over the eastern Jerusalem border. And the United States have said, Israel, don't boot them out. Don't do it. We don't want you to do it. And Hamas says, Israel, if you boot them out, we're going to fight against you. And so what Hamas feels and Iran feels that they have the United States on their side in terms of anything that Israel does in East Jerusalem that the Palestinians don't like, they are justified in their days of rage to fight against Israel. They have the backing of the United States, perhaps not to kill people. However, they have the moral support of the United States to go ahead and do what they want. At least the United States would say they're justified in that. Firing rockets on civilians is bad PR. Most people can see that. And so I think that that was there to show the Palestinian street that we are willing to put our bodies and our Hamas fighters on the line for you. And that does a lot. That goes a long way for Israeli Arabs to see Hamas that are willing to put themselves on the line. However, the strategic gains for in terms of the United States support, in terms of Palestinian support for Hamas going forward inside for actions inside East Jerusalem are huge. And this is why people need to watch this, because East Jerusalem is a critical factor in terms of biblical prophecy. Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 1 and 2 talk about events that directly precede the second coming of Christ, the day of the Lord, as it says there in verse 1. And Mr. Flory writes about this in his booklet on Zechariah. He talks about how there are three phases that come. The final phase is the return of Christ. The second phase is the great tribulation, which is spoken about in other prophecies. But directly preceding that, the first domino to fall, as he says, is East Jerusalem falling to the Arabs. And right now you have a United States government that firmly believes that Jews that own property inside East Jerusalem are not allowed to evict a Palestinian tenant that has not paid rent for 40 years. And so if you have the United States that's on the that believes that the East Jerusalem now already belongs to the Palestinian Arabs, why wouldn't they rise up and fight for it? And so people need to be watching as East Jerusalem gets more and more attention for this prophecy to be fulfilled. Also, there's another prophecy in Zechariah 14 and verse, 11 and verse 14. It talks about how the relationship between the United States and Israel, the Jewish state, will be broken. And we are going to see that. We already are. We're seeing the United States on this firmly supporting the number one state sponsor of terrorism and its proxies, whose number one enemy is the state of Israel. And so how long can this relationship last between the Biden administration and the state of Israel? That's another prophecy that we're watching to be fulfilled through this as well.
Well, the timing of all of this happening with this changeover in America's presidential administration is hardly coincidental. It's really a direct response to this change to an explicitly pro-Iran policy from the White House. I'd really recommend that you read Brent's article, Iran is Taking Over the Palestinian Street. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Anything else that you would send people to for more information, Brent?
I think if they're interested in the breaking of the brotherhood between Israel and the United States as well, an article, Band of Brothers, by Mr. Stephen Flory, is good to read too.
Well, thank you very much. Before we leave this subject, I want to talk about Germany with the Biden administration showing itself so hostile to Israel. The Jews are looking more and more to Germany as their closest ally. If I could bring Richard Palmer in on this, your thoughts on that aspect of what's happening here, Richard?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating angle. Die Welt had a headline just a few days ago called "The Next Attack on Israel's Existence Comes from the USA," pointing out how radical some of the radical left have been getting against Israel. You know, some of the things Brent's been talking about. This article said Israel has always been able to rely on Washington, but the current conflict shows how far the Democratic Party has slipped to the left. Demands by some congressmen are shaking the foundations of the Jewish state. Now, into that kind of vacuum, you're having Germany take on, I think, a bit bigger of a role. They are not, Germany is not the new Donald Trump. They are not Israel's friend, and you know, kind of as pro-Israel, pro-Netanyahu as President Trump was. I don't think they've really changed much. But America now kind of taking this much more radical turn under Joe Biden is kind of making Germany look like the least worst option in a whole lot of ways. So, for example, just over the last few days, you'd had Angela Merkel say, we stand for Israel's right to self-defense. And that's why it is right that Israel is taking massive action. So that is a more of a full-throated support of Israel than we've seen really from Joe Biden and some of the left in America. Heiko Maas, the German foreign minister, he's heading over there at the moment. He said, we've always stressed that Israel has a right to defend itself. Part of that is degrading the establishments from which the attacks on Israel are launched and preventing future attacks by making sure the infrastructure of those future attacks is no longer a danger. Others have made the point that it was the United States and not Germany that did the most to push for a ceasefire now. So with America looking so much more negative, by contrast, Germany is looking much more positive to Israel. And I think it's fascinating. Then you put this in the wider context where the Arab response to this conflict has been very different. You're not seeing massive condemnations of Israel from Saudi Arabia, from Lebanon, from the United Arab Emirates. They are being much more circumspect in the statements that they put out about what is going on here. And these trends just line up perfectly with Bible prophecy. The Bible talks about Israel turning to Germany. And then it talks about Israel being betrayed by Germany and being betrayed by Germany leading a coalition of Arab countries. Now you see Germany and some of those same Arab countries that the Bible talks about as betraying Israel, you see them looking much more positive, looking like the ones that Israel can lean on. Now, we spoke about anti-Semitism in Germany on the show last week. There are signs that are very clear that Israel should be wary about trusting Germany. But you are seeing Germany looking more trustworthy. You at least just look at Angela Merkel and some of her people right at the top. And you can really see it getting lined up now for Israel to trust more and more on Germany and this German-led Arab alliance, paving the way for exactly the kind of double cross that the Bible talks about.
Where would you send people for more information on that, Richard?
Well, our King of the South booklet is great for this whole subject, but then there's a section in this booklet called The Mysterious Alliance as well. That talks about this alliance of Arab nations that is prophesied to double cross Israel. So that'd be one good place to go to learn more about this.
Well, it's a huge subject, very important events that are unfolding there in Jerusalem. I would really encourage you to keep your eye on our website, watchjerusalem.co.il, for the very latest information about what is happening over there. These really, as Brent was bringing out, these tie into prophecies that we've been watching and talking about for decades now, and really they seem to be reaching a new accelerated speed in their fulfillment. I really appreciate that, both of you, Brent and Richard. Thanks very much. Another big story springing from the foreign policy of the Biden administration, this regarding a game-changing energy project between Russia and Germany. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, really something, almost startling story coming out of the United States, where Russia and Germany have been building this pipeline under the Baltic Sea to connect the two of them. And you know, it's massively strategic. Oil pipelines, they're always about a lot more than oil. President Donald Trump recognized how important this pipeline was, and he was very critical of it on a whole number of different occasions. And he talked about how it's tying Germany to Russia. It's really enabling Russia to gain control over Eastern Europe. And he worked very hard to stop it. And it was a pretty impressive demonstration in some ways of American financial power, kind of coming in there. I think the pipeline was 90, 95% done. The sanctions came in. The whole thing just shut down. Yeah. It was months, weeks away maybe from being finished. They couldn't get it done all of the way under President Trump. Now, President Biden wasn't particularly critical of what President Trump did here. And in fact, his foreign secretary had condemned the pipeline as well. But America very abruptly reversed courses this week. They removed certain countries or certain entities from American sanctions. So the Russian-owned Nord Stream 2 consortium based in Switzerland and then its German former Stasi agent CEO were taken off the U.S. blacklist. And you've got this situation now where it's not like a complete withdrawal of all sanctions, but America has withdrawn all the meaningful sanctions. And it's basically, everyone understands this now, like, okay, we're still giving you a bit of a slap on the wrist just to show that we disapprove, but we are not going to do anything close to what is necessary to stop this. If you want to move forward, we won't stop you. We'll just signal that we don't like it. So the EU Observer, for example, wrote that it was widely seen as a green light for Nord Stream 2 completion by both its enemies and its friends. And Germany, of course, is very happy about it. German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas. He said that it was that this decision was taking into account the really extraordinarily good relationship that had been built up with the Biden administration. It's an expression of the fact that Germany is an important partner for the U.S., one it can count on in the future. Russia, of course, is very happy. Germany's or America's Foreign Secretary, Secretary of State, I guess I should say, is meeting with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian Foreign Secretary, over in Iceland at the moment. Russia's very happy, but it kind of came out of nowhere and it upends America's policy in Europe.
Now, this is a story. It's a story that we've been following for a long time. The strategic implications of the completion of this pipeline are huge. Can you just explain the bigger picture on that front?
Yeah. So Russia has repeatedly used its pipelines for political power. You know, the friendlier you are as a country to Russia, the cheaper you have to pay, the less money you have to pay for your gas. That's just a factor throughout all of Europe. Then they've used it even more aggressively than that. In the past, say Ukraine, you do something that you don't like, fine, we're cutting off your gas in the middle of winter. Well, you heat your houses with your gas. Well, I'm afraid your citizens are just going to have to freeze. That's the way they've done it. But this carries some big downsides for Russia. If they cut off Ukraine, they cut off Austria. They cut off all these other countries that get money or they get their gas coming via Ukraine. Also, Russia has to hand over billions of dollars every year to countries like Ukraine, countries that it considers its enemy, to pay transit fees, to pay for Russian gas to come through those countries. Well, now they no longer have to pay that. And that money makes up an incredible percentage of Ukraine's national income. They don't have to pay that. Now, if they want to cut off Ukraine or any other Eastern European country, once this pipeline is completed, they can do so without cutting off the country's downstream. So it turns this into a precision weapon. And it gives Germany a similar control of the gas that then is flowing into Western Europe. It makes them the Western European gas hub. And then just to see these two countries working together, it's also a very important signal from Germany that we're looking east. We're contemplating an eastward alliance. You know, we're not completely behind NATO. We're not very much firmly in America's camp. We could go either way. We have some deals with America. We have some deals with Russia. We'll go whichever way we go. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has really drawn attention to this. He had an article a few years ago, Germany and Russia's secret war against America. And he wrote in that Nord Stream and Nord Stream 2 are key components of Putin's plan to tighten his grip on nations in Eastern Europe that used to be part of the Soviet Empire. Since these pipelines travel directly from Russia to Germany, they enable Putin to shut off the gas supplies to Eastern European nations. We went over that anyway. But he said this places a sharp edge on Putin's energy weapon. To the former Soviet nations that he is determined to bring back under Russian power, he can say either obey Russia or suffer cold winters with no gas to heat your homes.
So for the Biden administration to greenlight this project, this exposes quite a lot about his administration and its priorities. For as much as they accuse Donald Trump of being a Russian asset, it seems like he's doing a pretty good job of masquerading as one.
It's crazy. I mean, if there's anyone that still has any lingering doubts that Donald Trump might have been a Russian asset in some way, I mean, that's been blown up comprehensively over the last few years. But this just nukes it. I mean, how in what universe does it make any sense for Donald Trump to be a Russian stooge who puts in place all of these sanctions and shuts down one of Russia's biggest projects for expanding their power? And then Joe Biden is the one that will stand up to Russia, but he's the one that actually allows this to go ahead. It's the complete opposite of what we've been hearing from the radical left for the last 4 years.
And Stephen Flurry's brought out the additional paradox of the Biden administration's approach toward pipelines within the United States, shutting down the Keystone pipeline and yet permitting this to go on.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not an expert on the Keystone pipeline, but there's massive environmental issues with building a pipeline across the bottom of the ocean. People have been protesting that just purely from a kind of a green point of view, but somehow that's allowed to go ahead, whereas the Keystone pipeline, that's much less environmentally destructive. But that we've got to shut down. So we'll shut down American pipelines only and not European ones, not Russian ones. Like Mr. Flurry said on the show, it's America last.
So just talk about the prophetic implications here of this kind of cooperation between Germany and Russia.
So one of the key things that Mr. Flory focused on in that article I mentioned is how this really does telegraph Germany's intentions. They are done with the United States, and they're forming a close deal with Russia. He had a Key of David program on the same subject. And he talked about how, well, this shows that Germany is thinking about their own power. They're thinking about having their own version of the Holy Roman Empire. They've gotten all that they can from America. They're ready to move on. They're ready to build their own deals with Russia. And in that article, the last section is called The Seething Pot. The last section is A Great Cause to Hope. The penultimate is A Seething Pot. That talks about just this boiling resentment that is building within Germany for America. And so this telegraphs a massive geopolitical shift where actually Germany, instead of siding with America against Russia, they flip that entirely. And they bring all of Europe into siding with Russia against America. That's something that just changes the whole geopolitical landscape. But that is something that you see quite clearly with Nord Stream 2. And Donald Trump was fighting against that realignment. Apparently, Joe Biden seems to have given up.
Well, we have an article on the website right now from Mihailo Zekic. Biden gives Nord Stream 2 the green light. We will link to that in the show notes for today's program. We also have Germany and Russia's secret war against America, that article from Gerald Fleury from a few years back that Richard just referenced. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Now to China, which has set up a new digital currency that poses a threat to the dominance of the U.S. dollar. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, there was a really compelling analysis in the Washington Examiner this week all about China's new digital currency and just some of the effects this is likely to have worldwide. So this currency is officially called the Digital Currency Electronic Payment, and it marks the first time any major economy has made a concerted attempt to launch a digital currency. And the Examiner says that it is beginning to look like it could become a viable alternative to the U.S. dollar, which has, you know, for many decades been the currency of choice for international business. The main advantage that this digital currency has over the dollar and other traditional currencies is that since it's built on blockchain technology, it tracks transactions. Every point, you know, from factories to storage facility to cargo vessel to port, every point of a transaction is meticulously tracked. And that means just-in-time deliveries are possible and just-in-time payments are possible. And that equates to much better transaction security with a digital currency and transaction costs that are considerably lower. So those are some major advantages. And the Washington Examiner says that that could add up to really enhance the yuan's importance in the international finance system. So I don't think we should expect the United States or the nations of Europe to be signing up for this anytime soon, but less powerful Asian nations, especially those that are already bound to China through the Belt and Road Initiative and other economic links, we could begin seeing those nations transition more and more to the digital yuan. And then from there, it may not be long before many of the nations of Europe jump on board.
And what would be the implications to the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. dollar has dominated the global reserve currency dynamic for decades now, and it has also dominated the SWIFT system. That's the global messaging system that banks use to transfer money from one country to another. And the dollar's power in these systems has been just a huge part of America's economic might. And it's also given Washington major power over basically any country that imports or exports. You know, if the U.S. thinks that a nation like Iran is behaving in a dangerous way, it can block either the whole country out of the global financial system, or it can block just certain individuals or corporations. We just heard Richard talking about how that's worked with some Russian and German companies where President Trump had put these economic sanctions on just specific corporations and individuals. It's really a significant tool that gives the U.S.'s sanctions kind of a bite because you can just block those people out. But back in January, China actually formed a joint venture between SWIFT and its new digital currency. And the Examiner is speculating that the momentum being built here could become a big black eye for the dollar. One section of their article says, the digital yuan's acceptance beyond mainland China could bypass the networks of banks and financial institutions that are subject to U.S. laws. So pretty chilling implications there for America's ability to give bite to its sanctions and for the power of the U.S. dollar in general.
Now, you talk about the traceability of blockchain and just thinking about a tool like this in the hands of an authoritarian high-tech surveillance power like China. It seems like the implications of its power over those who use this currency is pretty staggering.
Yes, staggering and just chilling to think about it. You know, the Chinese Communist Party has staked its regime on an ability to watch and control private activity inside of China. It's believed that they now have about 560 million facial recognition cameras. So Big Brother is always watching, and they don't stop with just watching. There's also a social credit system incorporated into that surveillance apparatus. So if a camera spots someone jaywalking or smoking in a non-smoking zone or failing to pick up after their dog, his social credit score goes down. And then the CCP also monitors purchases as part of this program. You know, with more and more people in China using the digital yuan, every single transaction goes into an electronic ledger. And if the government sees you buying things that it disapproves of, you can bet your social credit score will go down. You know, people have been punished for buying symbols of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement, for buying flags of Taiwan. There are even reports of people's social credit score dropping if they spend more money on video games than the government deems appropriate. You know, in any kind of purchase like that can lower your social credit score. And if your score falls, the government will block you out of certain schools or jobs. It'll ban you from travel. There was a recent report showing that more than 17 million Chinese people are blocked each year from buying plane tickets. And that is due to their social credit score falling. And of course, for more serious infractions, a person may be put in a concentration camp or prison. So the government has astounding power over its own people. It's watching them vigilantly. It's punishing them. And you can be sure that if China can get the digital yuan accepted outside its borders, it'll be doing the same thing worldwide, though more on a national level, I think. If China saw that the Cambodian government was trying to buy U.S. weapons, or if it saw Laos importing machines from Japan, then the Chinese could block those transactions from even happening. And, you know, so just a lot of very chilling implications there. And, of course, this does make many people realize that the digital yuan gives China power over them. And so you may think that they would never want to adopt it. But analysts believe that as China grows more economically powerful, the eagerness of smaller governments and companies to secure short-term gains may override those concerns about the Chinese Communist Party. We've already seen that with the Belt and Road. Nations sign up even though they know it gives China worrying economic power over them. But the idea of having a brand new billion-dollar port or railway is just too enticing to turn down. So I think we can expect a lot of that same sort of thinking to happen with the digital yuan.
Well, Jeremiah has written an article about this subject, New Digital Currency, Putting Chinese Surveillance in Wallets Worldwide. And he discusses the prophetic implications of this development from China. I would encourage you to read that article to learn about that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, how America's military is embracing Marxism, America's soaring inflation, Prince Harry's fresh new accusations of racism in the British royal family, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
An alarming story now about the American military, how it is embracing leftist Marxist political ideology. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, a new book about the Marxist takeover of the United States hit the top spot on Amazon.com's bestseller list briefly this week after its author was relieved of his command at Space Force for promoting it. Colonel Matthew Lohmeyer was the commander of the 11th Space Warning Squadron at Buckley Air Force Base until he appeared on the Information Operation podcast with host Todd Wood to promote this book, which the title of the book is Irresistible Revolution, Marxism's Goal of Conquest, and the Unmaking of the American Military. And on that program, he really focused in it mostly about critical race theory, specifically critical race theory in some of the military's new diversity training programs. He told the host of that podcast, "Our diversity, inclusion, and equality industry and the trainings we've received in the military via that industry are rooted in critical race theory, which is rooted in Marxism." And he went in quite a bit of detail explaining that, and then also explaining about how the military right now, they're giving out training pamphlets exposing the white supremacist extremism in the Capitol protest from January 6th. But then, like, none of those training pamphlets have any information about the Black Lives Matter protest or that have caused so many billions of dollars of damage throughout U.S. cities. And this diversity, these diversity programs, they're coming straight from the critical race theory movement, which is self-avowedly Marxist. Mm-hmm. The host of that podcast, Todd Wood, he even joked with Colonel Lohmeyer at the end of it. He's like, "Well, you're probably going to get fired for saying this." And then Colonel Lohmeyer's like, "Well, no, I don't think that would ever happen." He's like, he said, "Most of my research for my book was taken from books already available at military libraries." Mm. He's like, "I don't think they could fire me for just adding another book against communism to their already existing libraries."
Wrong.
And yeah, within hours of the program, he was fired. I guess, quote, the reason they gave was a loss of trust and confidence in his ability to lead. And so, which surprised quite a few people. Senator Ted Cruz has spoken out against it, where he said that this guy, he's clearly fired this a well-respected Space Force military commander for speaking against communism. Like, in the United States of America, you have a military commander who can no longer keep commanding in the military because he's anti-communist. And there's plenty of warning signs that this may just be one of the first dominoes to fall in a much larger military purge. The Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, he also just appointed a few weeks back a man named Bishop Garrison as the Pentagon's new anti-extremism czar. And his job is, he's running this group that's basically going through the social media posts and the internet search histories of all the soldiers, looking for evidence of either right-wing or white supremacist extremism in order to, like, stop anything from, like, the January 6th protests from happening again. And apparently the search is so thorough that, like, the government's not even allowed to look that deeply into the search histories of its soldiers. They're actually having to contract through a private investigative firm, probably one called Babylon Street, in order to do this. Hmm. And at first, that doesn't sound like the worst thing in the world to, like, try to get white supremacists out of the military. However, when this Bishop Garrison, they've returned the favor for what he's doing to others and combed through some of his tweets. And found tweets he made that he said, there's one from 2019, a couple years back, where he said that anyone who could possibly vote for Donald Trump is a sexist and a racist and an extremist. So that seems to be his criteria for his search histories. He's looking for basically any Trump supporter, anyone who thinks that the election was stolen, or anyone who said anything negative against communism. And looking at to purge them out of the U.S. Armed Forces.
And the Biden administration seems to support that view, given the fact that they're putting him in such a position of authority in the military. So essentially you have individuals like this author who is against communism, and those who may have voted for Donald Trump or have some view that the Orthodox group on the left says is incorrect, and you have the leftists that are increasingly in control of the military. This doesn't seem like the makings of a very healthy, unified military.
No, because I mean the Democrats' long-term strategy here is to just purge out all conservative elements from the military and have like this left-wing proletariat guard to protect their new regime. But in the short term, you're causing tremendous division in the military and also tremendous division between current officers who are left-wing enough to keep their job and a growing pool of former officers who are too conservative to keep theirs. Because this story, it comes about the same week where there was a letter published by 120 retired American generals and admirals that said, "We are in the fight for our survival as a constitutional republic, no other time since our founding in 1776. The conflict is between supporters of socialism and Marxism versus supporters of constitutional freedom and liberty." So that's a huge body of people who've either retired from the military due to age or been fired, who are saying the same thing that this fired Space Force commander is saying, that there's a huge fight in the country between being a constitutional republic and being a Marxist dictatorship. And so, I mean, you're just looking like, oh, where is this going to lead? You've got basically, you've got the makings of civil war here, where you've got an officer's corps in the military that's getting more and more Marxist and socialism as they fire people. But then as you fire people, you've got this growing, almost like shadow officer's corps of people who support the Constitution. And it reminded me when I was reading the story of a quote from our editor-in-chief's latest article that's entitled "What Will Happen After Trump Regains Power." In that article, Mr. Fleury explains that President Trump was the legitimate winner of the 2020 presidential election, and he also explains that Bible prophecy says that President Trump will return to power, but, quote, "The indication is that regaining office may take considerable work. Donald Trump will have to fight for it. It doesn't have to be military action, but it certainly could be. President Trump could also lead some states to secede from the Union. That would lead to some kind of warfare." So Mr. Fuller is going through this prophecy, mainly the one in 2 Kings 14, about an end-time figure of end-time type of King Jeroboam II, warring to regain and expand his a territory, and using that word "war" to show there that there's a pretty strong indication, at least in that scripture, that there will be some sort of a really intense action for President Trump to get back in the presidency. And then now you're seeing 120 admirals and generals and growing lining up behind the conservative movement, and warning that the people who are still in the Biden-Harris administration's military are supporting Marxism. So you're really starting to see those fault lines for a civil war like that develop by the day.
That's pretty ugly stuff, and I'm glad you just drew attention to that that statement from Gerald Fleury. The title of that article again: What Will Happen After Trump Regains Power. We'll link to that in the show notes, as well as this article by Andrew Miller, "Marxism is Dividing America's Military." Go check it out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Andrew. China is strengthening its position in Central Asia, historically Russia's sphere of influence. To learn about how it is accomplishing this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, back in 2013, when Chinese leader Xi Jinping first announced plans for his big Belt and Road Initiative, which is, you know, designed to just better link China with Europe and other parts of Asia, some of the countries of Central Asia were the very first to eagerly sign on to this project. Kazakhstan was the very first. It started to call itself the buckle of China's belt. And in the years since then, Kazakhstan has worked with China to build the Korgos Inland Port, the Oktau Port, the Astana Light Rail, and more than 40 other infrastructure projects across the country. So just an astounding amount of Chinese activity in Kazakhstan. And then the same thing is happening in Tajikistan. Accumulated Chinese investment there is now at more than 35% of the total volume of foreign investment. Last year alone, that figure was over $3 billion worth, so just an incredible amount of money for a nation with a GDP of just $8 billion. And then the same basic trend is underway in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and also Turkmenistan. So really all across Central Asia, China is building incredible amounts of infrastructure and clout. There was a little bit of a lull in all of this last year, but now it's charging ahead at full force. And when you place this alongside China's rapidly increasing trade with these nations, it all adds up to give China just a remarkably deep level of influence in this very important global region.
These nations that you're talking about here, many of them former Soviet satellite states, the fact that China is taking this aggressive of a posture here, it seems like they're receiving a certain amount of compliance from Russia in this.
It's a really interesting part of this story. As you said, these were mostly Soviet Union nations. They were under Moscow's control, and Russia still views Central Asia as part of its sphere of influence. Mm. We often talk about Russian President Vladimir Putin's determination to rebuild the geography of the Soviet Union and kind of pull all those old nations back under Moscow's control. And some experts had forecast that Russia's Soviet legacy in Central Asia and just its ongoing strategic interests there would clash with China's increasing interests. But in reality, it looks like Russia and China have come to an agreement, and they're kind of approaching this region in tandem. They're doing this primarily through the multinational security group called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the SCO. This organization is led by Russia and China, and it includes pretty much all of those Central Asian nations, I believe with the exception of Uzbekistan. But the evidence shows that by approaching Central Asia through this SCO framework jointly, Russia and China are able to minimize competition with each other and instead cooperate.
Very interesting to see that developing, particularly the cooperation between China and Russia that just never seems to be slowing down at all. We will link to an article from Gerald Fleury, The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man, that discusses the times of the Gentiles prophecy, showing the end result of this cooperation among these Asian giants. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Inflation in America continues to skyrocket. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, I think we talked about inflation on this program a couple weeks ago, but the problem continues to get worse and worse. They recently released the April statistics and found that the year-over-year inflation rate is now 4.2%. That's up from 2.6% last month. Mm-hmm. And so 4.2%, that's a 13-year high. That's a 13-year high. And an indication is that that it may get worse in the near future. Some aspects of the economy already worse. I think they actually said that like the price on used vehicles has gone. The inflation rate is like 21%. Mm-hmm. And the price on food, it varies product to product, but it's pretty well across the board. It's higher than the 4.2 they're reporting overall. So yeah, just as we've pointed out many times before, as you just keep printing and borrowing more and more and more money, I mean, it's leading towards the destruction of the American economy. And this these current inflation statistics are showing that just the strength of the dollar as like a stable reserve of money is eroding away quickly.
Well, it is a concerning development that really, again, is a direct result of the policies of the current American administration. If you want some personal counsel about what to do about this, we'd recommend reading our booklet, How to Solve Your Money Troubles. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you for that, Andrew. One final story. Prince Harry says he wants to leave the royal limelight, retire to the quietude of civilian life. He doesn't seem to be able to stay out of the headlines for long. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Prince Harry has dropped another bombshell interview, or it was actually the launch of his new documentary series that he conducted along with Oprah called The Me You Can't See. And once again, he launched some explosive accusations at the royal family. He accused them of total neglect. He said they had bullied him into silence. He talked more about his wife, the Duchess of Sussex, and said that she was actually quite detailed in terms of how she said she was going to commit suicide and how miserable she was, saying that she would have followed through with it, but she felt sorry for for Harry having lost his mother already and so didn't do that. He said that Prince Charles made him suffer as a child. He even kind of talked a bit more about racism as well. He said, my mother was chased to her death while she was in a relationship with somebody who wasn't white. And now look what's happened. So again, indicating there that the royal family is racist. So more of the same from Prince Harry. And then a second item of big news that if anything has been bigger over here in the UK, where the BBC has been exposed, where they told some pretty explosive lies all the way back in 1995 to persuade Princess Diana to come into an interview. They basically made up fake evidence that Princess Diana was being spied on. This kind of fed her paranoia, made her feel the royal family was out to get her, and led to her being much more assertive and aggressive in her attacks on the royal family than she probably would have been. But really, both of these stories are part of a decline that we've seen over quite a few years. In the royal family, we have an article, The Fall of the British Royal Family, from the September 2017 Trumpet print edition that will introduce you to this subject. But this is more than just kind of social gossip. There is a very important story here that's important to all of Britain, all of the United States. Mr. Flurry said very clearly in that 2017 article that we'd see the royal family going down, and he outlined exactly why. We have seen that forecast proven true. And I'm about out of time, but it's important to go and understand why he said that, what the prophecies were behind that, because it's something that we've seen spectacularly proven true over the last few years.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our whole panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Also, thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Never lose an opportunity of seeing anything beautiful, for beauty is God's handwriting. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.